First, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here, and actually a bit scary to talk in front of a mostly physics audience. I'm a geomathematician working in, I'm an analyst, complex analyst, and I started to work on an equation with that Schramm some years ago. Maybe a little later I'll tell a little bit my way into that. I mean, I've been interested in similar questions for a long time before SLE was invented, PLA and so on, so I'll come to that. I was asked to give a pedagogical talk, and I don't quite know what that is, but long ago I used to use only the blackboard for talks, and then at some point, especially in the realm, then I did some complex dynamics, the pictures were useful, but then especially with that SLE, it is more useful to use pictures, and the formulas get complicated, so I switched to slides, and here I left my slides home because I didn't think I would give such a talk. But then, anyway, so now I give a blackboard talk. It's the first blackboard talk in a long, long time, and I guess you'll have to bear with me, my handwriting, everything else. So maybe, so here is an outline of the talk first. I mean, there's so many ways to begin this, but I chose to start just with the Loebner equation, which is certainly natural for an analyst. So the Loebner equation, and there will be nothing stochastic in this for a while. So this is going to be a deterministic Loebner equation from classical complex analysis. Then I will put that S into that LE. So I will talk about the Schramm Loebner evolution. And I will sort of come to that naturally by looking at that conformal Markov. Markov property, which is often called now also the Schramm's principle, which is a very simple to describe axiom on a family of random curves that you have to impose in order for them to be described by its stochastic, by the Schramm's Loebner evolution. Well, then I'll show a few slides. So then I will actually turn on the projector and show pictures and explain a few models of random planar curves from statistical physics or probability. So statistical physics models, we can associate some in some sometimes a bit delicate way some curves that then in the scaling limit at criticality converge to SLEs. And then I would like to explain a bit more. I mean, that certainly gives enough motivation to say why SLE is interesting. And then I'll say something about properties. SLE comes with a parameter, a positive real number, usually called kappa. And then I'll say something about properties that are shared by all SLE kappa, so for all parameters kappa, or you know, just viewing that as for each kappa, you have an interesting family of random curves, and what can you say about those in general without referring to the physics models? Then there are a few specific values of kappa where the SLE has a very particular extra properties, basically the restriction property or locality. So I'll say a little bit about that. So John Cardi mentioned that yesterday. So say a few more words about this conformal restriction. One of the reasons is that that is one of my favorite applications, actually, and things. So I will sketch a very, I mean, how out of this theory a proof of that Mandelbrot conjecture, one of the first big successes of the theory, one of the, I mean, that sort of made the whole theory, I guess, famous, that Mandelbrot's conjecture, but the house of dimension of the Brownian frontier being 4/3, that was the first success here, together with, of course, the intersection exponents. Well, and then finally, I would like to say a little bit on how to compute with SLE. I mean, this is mathematically, everything is mathematically rigorous, but of course, in order to prove theorems, you will need some techniques, and the tool here is stochastic calculus. Of course, so here I'll explain briefly how to compute. With SLE, basically I'll compute a few simple probabilities and we'll explain the Ito calculus on the way. Ito was another mathematician who was awarded high honors at the ICM yesterday. Right, so that's the program, and at the end, if there's time, I want to explain a little bit about the things that I'm personally interested these days also that are very closely related to SLE, but a bit different coming from more the analyst's point of view. All right, so then I was asked to produce a little manuscript or something that could be distributed audience, but the problem is I don't have something that is, you can already see you don't want to read my manuscript, the handwritten. I don't have a typed up version. But there is a large number of overview articles, even though the field is very young. I mean, it's 2000 as when it started, but there is quite a few overview articles, and I just read, I don't write them down, but there is, for instance, a Greg Lawless book, Conformal Invariant Processes in the Plane, which I highly recommend. But of course, these overview articles, they are written by people, and these people have their areas of specialty. Lawler is a probabilist, so that is written. He's a very, of course, formal, precise mathematician, so this is written on a more formal level, totally rigorous. Then John Cardy has a nice nice overview article, which is called SLE for Theoretical Physicists. So that's another source that is good. Then I found, just Googling, on archive, just putting in SLE, it came 200 papers, and I found one article that I haven't seen before that I quite liked. Michel Bauer and Denis Bernard, they have an article called Loebner Chains, and browsing over it, I even found the word it's a pedagogical introduction, which I found it only this morning, so I haven't really incorporated it too much, I guess. It has a lot of pictures and explains a lot of the statistical physics models. Then Wouter Kager and Nienhuis, they wrote a paper a couple of years ago, A Guide to Stochastic Loebner Evolution and Applications, and I quite like that one. I mean, it gives it's a little bit closer to what I'm going to do here too. It gives a rather mathematically rigorous, I mean, it doesn't have all proofs in it.
Could you write the name of the author?
Oh yeah, maybe I should actually then write it. I thought everybody knows all these sources anyway.
Yeah, on the wiki page, on the wiki space, we'll put the links to all this.
Okay. Then you also probably put your article there, right? Yeah, Witzberg has a, that title is a bit long, I just copied on stochastic geometry, and then it goes on. And then there is another article that I quite like. It's just a 3 or 5 page paper, also by and Leo Kadanov, which is called The Loebner Equation, Maps and Shapes. And this is a, I must say I was impressed, because in the first few years of SLE, mathematicians, I think, did not produce a good readable source. So the enthusiasm within the math community, I felt, was very small compared to the impact that I thought I saw right away. But in the physics literature, I was impressed that there was a very, very readable, very nicely illustrated article. Well, and whenever I was asked by mathematicians, whether it is a senior or junior students, I refer to that article. Yeah. And together with, I said, of course, there are the Lawler, Schramm, Werner papers, which are great papers, very important, beautiful mathematics, the ACTA papers, but I don't recommend them to undergraduates, of course. They will be scared away and don't want to look at it. Anyway, so that is a very nice, just to get started, to, as a teaser, I mean, really as a teaser, to be interested in the area. When physicists say that this is some important mathematics being done that adds something to the physicists, I mean, that is a good advertisement too. Anyway, so that's a brief primer to the literature. So then let me start with the Loebner equation. The Loebner equation is, I guess I should say, it provides a sort of a map. So the idea is this: you have a curve in the plane, and I'll say more about it later, but think about a simple curve. So you have a curve in the plane, and it provides a sort of one-to-one correspondence between such curves and one-dimensional real-valued functions. So real-valued functions. So let's call these functions maybe WT. So it's a function from the positive reals to the reals. So this two-dimensional information gets encoded in a one-dimensional information, which, of course, I mean, makes things, in a sense, ought to give some advantages. the prices you have to put something in. So this correspondence goes both ways, and the link is provided by Conformal Maps. So I first even, we all know that, but I'll say a few words about conformal maps, because that often leads, I see it in discussion with non-complex analysts, to some slight confusions. So let me review the Riemann mapping theorem. So it says whenever you have in the two-dimensional, in the plane, a simply connected domain, and it shouldn't be the whole plane, that just means it has no holes. It's an open set with no holes, maybe something like this. Or let me actually, for pedagogical reasons, just take a rectangle. Then there is a conformal map. There is a conformal map F that maps this rectangle to any other simply connected domain. So for instance, to the disk. So typically, one of the favorite domains is the unit disk, disk of radius 1. So then there's a conformal map F that maps that rectangle or domain D to the unit disk, often denoted D this way. And it is unique up to three real parameters. So these three real parameters are often fixed this way, that you fix one point. For instance, in that case, you would take a symmetry point that goes to, say, to zero. That's two real coordinates here. And then you still have one degree of freedom or rotation of that disk, which you can fix by describing a boundary point or setting the argument of the derivative. So there are three ways to normalize that. So what does conformal actually mean? So conformal Well, the geometer would think of it as just angle preserving. So that is, say, right angles here are just going to be preserved like, well, like this. Analysts would think of it as saying, well, it is it's an analytic map, it's complex differentiable, so locally it's a power series, and then it is also one-to-one, it's injective. And of course, locally, so if you look at a very, very small, at some point in a very, very small neighborhood, there is something that sometimes called the Eck-York principle. I think Kurt McMahon maybe coined that term. If you think of it maybe rather this way around, as a, you have the disk, I mean maybe the inverse. So if you take a smaller disk, so of size 1/2 inside, then what can a conformal map do to this configuration? Conformal map of the big disk. The big disk can be mapped to anything. It can be a really complicated thing. Well, it cannot have this, right? But it could go out, ways out, and so on. But this one in the inside is actually not changed much. It's still very close to a disk. So it's like the egg, the yolk sort of stays together, and the white can sort of splatter everywhere. So the closer you zoom in, the more, of course, the map looks just like a C-linear map. So it's a conformal, it's a linear map. It's just a dilation and a rotation. But globally, over the whole domain, there is not much regularity provided. All right, so I would like to illustrate that just by a simple question, I mean almost like a quiz. So if this were a 3x1 rectangle, let's suppose it's 3x1, what is then the size of the image of this one side? Something like this. What would you guess? And I guess maybe nobody dares.
In or out?
The inside to the inside. Again? No, there is. Oh, yeah, that's a good suggestion. Thanks. I mean, I should like to say that. So from the inside that domain, this map is actually very nice. It's two different points get mapped to different points, and it maps onto. And on the boundary, the map is sort of as good as the boundary is. It's, most theorems go actually rather this way, conformal maps from the disk to some domain. Let's call it G. And it goes like the smoothness of G up to the boundary is almost, it's basically the same as the smoothness of the boundary. So if the boundary is an analytic curve, G is actually analytic across the, I mean, it's analytic in a bigger disk. If this is a smooth curve, then the G is still smooth up to the boundary. And, you know, if it has K derivatives, then still the G has K derivatives. There's a little epsilon that is wrong here, and so on. So if this is just a curve like here, so a simple curve, then already this conformal map extends continuously to the boundary and is still a homeomorphism on the boundary. So two different points correspond to different points. But one, so it really is a homeomorphism of the closed disk in this case. And here it actually is going to be locally analytic. It's just going to have four singularities, sort of a square root type, corresponding to these two points, to these four points. And I was sort of asking where are these four points? And I think the naive intuition is to think at the typical smooth map. I mean, you would write on a linear map, which is this thing has length. I mean, it's 3, 3, 1, 1 has length 8, and if you split it up evenly, you would expect something like an eighth. Maybe you say, well, it's a bit less, yeah. But it turns out this is already just a hundredth of the length, roughly. I mean, that's the order of dimensions. So, an honest picture of that map would just make this already hardly visible, and that's an effect. Which produces, of course, some problems, but also mathematical challenges, numerical challenges. The rule basically is if it is a 1 by L, the size here decays exponentially, like e to the negative pi times the length. So it's an exponential decay.
Because e to the minus pi is a very small number.
Exactly, yeah. E to the minus pi times 10 or 100 is an even smaller number. And then the problem is, so if your domain has something, I mean, in a sense, a zero angle cusp, you can hardly distinguish that from an infinite parallel strip. So the conformal map corresponding to such a point has similar sort of singularity of a very, very, it decays extremely, I mean, behaves very badly. It is still a nice sort of, the conformal map using this function here to parametrize this curve is still a nice sort of, you know, it goes around, it never stops, but it has very sort of irregular behavior. Oh yeah, that makes sense. Then it actually is should have more than the length. You're right. From the outside, it is very well exposed. Ilya is in his talk is going to say a bit more about it. The size of that over here is something that you call the harmonic measure. And a good way to visualize that is actually you can think of starting a Brownian motion, two-dimensional Brownian motion, say at that point. And you stop it as soon as it hits the boundary. The conformal invariance says, so if I conformally map this over here, it just is the same as starting a Brownian motion over here and wondering where it hits. And then it is sort of clear, making it through the end of a long tunnel. I mean, think you're sort of, you know, blindfolded, drunk, and you're here in the middle of a room, you need to find that exit. I mean, you stumble around. It's very, very unlikely. The longer it is, I mean, it's more likely to hit this wall, right? Every time you advance one step, it's as likely to hit the wall than that one. Actually, Odette Schramm, quite a few years ago, he very much impressed me. This I learned from my advisor, Complex Analysis. Oh no, Don Marshall in Seattle, he has done a lot of numerical conformal mapping and developed a nice algorithm. But anyway, so I learned that phenomenon from him, so I asked Odette about that probability, and he was one of the very few people who came up with a good number, I mean, with a reasonable approximation, just within a few seconds. I mean, by saying that the argument, you could say, you know, the chance if you start here to hit the top, take a very simple approximation by this grid here. So you just go one step up, and you have two steps here. And you wonder if you do a symmetric random walk as a primitive approximation to Brownian motion. You start here. So if you go up or down immediately, you're killed. You haven't made it to that side. So the only way to get over here is if you go to the right immediately. Then here again, if you go up or down, you're dead. So it would be another right step. So you need three steps to the right, which is 1/64th, and that's actually relatively close to the actual value. I mean, this is too fast of a convergence, but that's a theorem behind, right, that the discrete simple random walk converging to Brownian motion. Of course, I mean, we could have gone backwards, there's a lot of, but it's a good intuition. Anyway, so we already discussed that the sort of the regularity of this map is basically identical to the regularity of the boundary, but that also means, and that's a problem that is, I guess, not of very much relevance to the physicists, but very much so to the mathematicians. So if the domain is actually very wild, so let's think of a topologist sine curve, something that oscillates and accumulates towards a line segment, and you fatten it up, so you make it sort of a snail. So the inside of this thing here. So this is my domain D. Now still, it is a simply connected, it's open connected set without holes. So there is a one-to-one correspondence between the disk and this thing. Let's say zero to here. But now this conformal map here cannot be continuous up to the boundary. So inside the disk, it's very, very smooth. It's just locally, it looks like it's a dilation and rotation, but it's at the boundary, there is going to be one boundary point corresponding to this whole line segment. Let's draw this one over here. And what happens as I approach in the disk that one point, the image under that map is going to sort of wiggle around and oscillate. And so obviously it's not continuous. It never ends. So that's one of the little challenges that that appear. So, okay. A formula? Well, I don't want to. But let's say this graph here. I mean, if you take this here, yeah, then it is y is sine 1 over x, I guess. As x goes to 0, you can pick up more and more frequencies, and you just take a little tube around it. Okay, that's an exercise. Write down a formula. Okay, so then I, being a complex analyst, I can't help it, but I should mention, especially why that name Loewner is here, and I'm spending too much time maybe, but still, the study of these conformal maps is an ancient, very important, I mean, nice field within mathematics and complex analysis, starting at the beginning of the 20th century, or late in the 19th actually. People looked at just conformal maps in disk because that's a good normalization. And there was a famous problem, the so-called Bieberbach conjecture. So this is a little history sort of, which said this. So if I have a conformal map from the disk to any domain, D to D conformal, well, then being an analytic function, it has a power series and it converges in that disk because that's where it's analytic. So we can write it as a sum a n z to the n from, say, term 0 to infinity. The 0 term is a constant, the translation doesn't matter. But so what Bieberbach observed in 1914, I think, is that the second coefficient is always at most 2 times the first. And he made that sort of bold conjecture that the nth coefficient would be at most n times the first. And that was supported by the very special function. If you put just n times z to the n, you get a very special function, z over 1 minus z squared, which is the conformal map from a disk to a plane slit by a curve. So 0 goes to 0. And if you remove the slit from negative 1/4 to infinity, so the complement, it's a domain without holes, and the conformal map from here to here has exactly that property, and it was supposed to be extrema. Then in the early 20s, 1923, I think, Karl Loewner, he developed that method, that Loewner differential equation, and proved using that actually the third coefficient is less than 3 times the first. And then decades and decades of research went into that area that spread a lot of new important techniques that are still used, not for that problem anymore, but finally in 1985, I think, Louis de Branche proved that conjecture for all n. And interesting enough, the method, I mean, he used a couple methods, but sort of the key method was actually, again, the Loewner equation. So the Loewner equation was, in a sense, the one of the winners in that competition. Then the Leibniz equation got forgotten for about maybe 15 years or so, and then in the late, very late 90s, that sort of came naturally to, I mean, to sort of reconsider it. But in a sense, I think he sort of rather rediscovered it, because it's not a very difficult equation anyway, we'll see. Okay, so what is that Leibniz equation? I already said the Leibniz equation encodes a curve in the plane by means of a real valued function. So maybe I'll do that somewhere over here. And there are many different settings, but let's now to fix something, let's suppose that gamma is a curve, and let's suppose it's a curve in the upper half plane. I write H for upper half plane. And for a moment, let's suppose it's a simple curve, so it has no loops. And let's suppose it starts at the origin. So here is the upper half plane, real line, here's zero, and I have a curve like this. And then I can, of course, study that curve by, or characterize that curve by its complement. So what I could do is, let's suppose it's parametrized already, that down here is gamma of zero, and then as t increases, this is gamma of t. Now what I can do is I just run that curve only up to a time t. So here's gamma of t, and I sort of forget about the rest, the future of the curve. Then what I see, the half plane minus that portion of the curve, so now it would be this domain here, is a simply connected domain in the plane. It's an open set without holes. And so there is a conformal map that is often called then, I mean, it depends on t. When I take a different t, I get a different domain, so I get a map g sub t from that half plane to the upper half plane again. So gt from h minus the curve gamma from 0 to t to h is a conformal. And there are 3 degrees of freedom, so we still can normalize a little bit. So we want to fix it so that infinity goes to infinity. Then it already looks at infinity automatically, like a constant times z plus another constant, and then an alpha 1 over z, and so on. So that uses up 1 degree by just saying infinity is fixed. So now I can scale, I mean, I can post-compose with a real factor, actually with 1 over alpha, without changing the half plane here, that kills this term, and then I still have 1 degree of freedom left. And this one I can translate by that number to kill that one too. And then I have used up all my freedoms, and so this is, so the error terms here of order 1 over z squared, and so that is my unique map now. That number, of course, is going to depend on t. For another number t, so I should write alpha 1 of t. Okay, and now...
Sorry, for a question. I mean, sometimes people say this is called hyperdynamic.
Yes. Oh, I think it is if you look at the flow of... if you have an obstacle and you take a fluid or airflow along such a thing, then you, what you do is you study, I think you conformally map this to the complement of, you know, the complement of your obstacle to the complement of that, and then that's a normalization that is the right one that takes these flow lines. So here you wouldn't see the obstacle to the ones.
The flow will be horizontal in the half plane as you've drawn it there, so it will be horizontal at infinity. So you're looking at the flow past an obstacle.
Well, here you can always, you can always reflect, you know, that you can...
so you could reflect it if you wanted, And the 1 just means that you have unit velocity at infinity. So the real part of g is the velocity.
Okay, so then there are lots of little odds and ends, and of course I was asked to, and I won't talk about too many details, but one thing is sort of important, that as t increases, so as t increases, I get more of the curve, so I get a different conformal map, g sub t, and it's very easy to see that this number is actually a real number, just because you can compute it as a derivative along the real, and real goes to real. But it's also very easy to see that this number is actually increasing in t, and it's strictly increasing. So for a larger t-value, I get a larger number here. This number is sometimes called the capacity, but it's not really a capacity in that sense, not logarithmic capacity. Odette probably coined the term half-plane capacity of this slit here. And then it sort of, it's at least intuitive. The larger the set, the larger its capacity. All right, so because it is increasing, I have still freedom, and there's some information about that curve that I sort of probably can't retain, really, the parameterization of the curve. So I can always reparameterize that curve in order to get a function that I like. Yeah? So now I will reparameterize. I change the speed, maybe, with which I run through that curve in order to get a function here, which is basically the identity. So this one I now want to replace by a... And t would be the most obvious choice. 2t is sort of the choice that goes along. It's a historical choice with the first version of the Luhmann equation, which was in a different world, not in the half plane, but in the disk. So think of it that 2 is a historical accident, if you want to, but that's t. Well, at least you can see when t equals 0, when t equals 0, we haven't removed anything. Then we have the identity map, which just looks like z, so there's a 0 here. And then as t increases, it should increase. And this is a simple increasing function. So this you can always achieve. And this is, so you should keep in mind, given your curve, you have to reparameterize it so that it actually does that for the theory to work. Then, Leuvenus theorem. It's not really Leuvenus theorem. It's, I'm not sure if it's somewhere in the literature before Odette came along, but in the disk version, which is even sort of more complicated, it's Leuvenus, so that's still then called Leuvenus, basically. Now we want to say what happens as time changes with these maps GT. So the time derivative of GT at Z is actually extremely simple. So it is just 2 over GT of Z minus something. And that something, maybe I should just write it down. So we have removed that slit. And it is a simple fact. I mean, it's not hard to prove within complex analysis that maybe I should use different colors. That slit here actually has two sides to it. I mean, it's just one curve, but it has a left side, say the red one, and the same curve traced back on the other side. So this has zero width here, okay? And then when I map this to the half plane, sort of this slit here sort of opens up, folds open, and so the left part becomes an interval here on the left, and the right becomes an interval on the right. So this point zero here has two pre-images, one at the very left, and then another one at the very right. So these two guys get folded together to form the slit. And of course, that point here at the very tip, that has only one pre-image, which goes over here. It's a fact, it's not difficult, but it's also not trivial, that this map here, it does extend continuously up to the boundary. Remember our discussion over here, but if this is a curve, if this is really continuous, then there's no problem, and this point here is well defined. It's a real point, it depends on t, let's call this one WT. So, WT is just the image GT of that tip, which is gamma of T. All right, so I won't prove it, but the proof is actually very simple. But I'll explain rather in a picture what is behind this. Maybe I'll do this over here. Well, I think one thing is sort of also important here, what I should mention is that this function, so for next time, I mean for a larger time t, I will get another inner, that the function t maps to t, w2 is continuous. It is a continuous function. Okay, so now I want to give a very quick sort of sequence of pictures here. Maybe I should start it here. All right. So I think of that Leuvenus equation as a way of writing a conformal map, writing this conformal map as a sort of when you integrate that. So that means you just, and then discretize. then what you actually do is you write this conformal map as a composition of conformal maps in small steps. Yeah, so sort of infinitesimal conformal maps. So if we want to do that in a picture here, so let's say we fix a terminal time t, and we pick a couple of intermediate times, t1, t2. And then what I can do, I can first flatten out only this part here of the curve. I take a conformal map from the complement, the half plane minus that part to the half plane. It's going to take this point to, well, the point that we call WT1. And it's going to drag that curve, which is now inside the domain of this conformal map GT1. It's going to drag this curve over. And so this point, you know, this part here is, you know, it's going to map to something. So these two remaining points are now over here. And then I can use another conformal map, and you should do it like this, to pull down that next piece of curve here. So it's going to fold that open, and you should draw it like this. And now what is left is only one piece of slit. This is not the map G. I mean, this is a... The total map from here to here is a composition of these two conformal maps and has mapped down that whole thing. So this map is actually GT2. So the point down here is WT2. And then I have one last conformal map to flatten down this piece, and it takes that last tip to WT3. That's a very, very simple method and a very simple way to interpret this, but it's very useful. So first of all, you can use this to, you just reverse the steps here, and this way you can build up your original conformal map. And technically, this is a very important part in a lot of the sort of hardcore math work on SLE, to rather represent the conformal map this way, you rather go that way, you look at the sort of inverse equation. So you don't look actually at this differential equation here, but you throw in a negative sign, which is reverses time, and here you change, then going backwards means you just put a capital T minus little t in. And then you use for nice processes like Brownian motion that you haven't changed it. Going Brownian motion backwards, it's again a Brownian motion.
I think on the left lower picture it should be W of capital T, should it not?
Oh, very, very good, yes, thank you. Let's fix it. You're right, yeah, thanks. Okay, so that is, and then the Loebner equation actually amounts, and it's a very simple, it's an exercise in studying these infinitesimal maps here. So every step, if it's a very small step here, is very close to the identity, of course, because we pulled down something very, very little. And then this can be rewritten sort of as a derivative of these infinitesimal maps. So if this is a map from the change from T1 to T, let's call this one TST, then it is basically the derivative. So the limit as t goes to s goes to t, say, you know, 1 over s minus t. And then you have the deviation from the identity, phi st minus the identity. And essentially, you just have to show that that converges to 1 over w t. And that's a simple thing. It's a simple exercise in complex analysis. So that's almost, I mean, that's on the undergraduate level, but it's very, very powerful. Okay, so let's then say a word about, I should pick up the speed a bit, but okay, so what do I mean by curve here? So for simple curves, you can sort of see that this all makes sense, but you can do more general than simple curves. So what are curves that are sort of admissible if our goal is that this function WT here is continuous? And so admissible ones are actually curves, so let's call them admissible, are curves where it sort of touch themselves. So if it's a curve, it goes like this and then bounces back off. So again, what I can do is I can run a Loebner equation. I can run that, take, you know, I have parametrized in some way, I remove a part of that curve, let's say up to here, and map that down to the half plane. So what happens then? Let's maybe draw that. So it has a left part and a right part that's lit, and when I conformally map this down, I get first the real line, then I get the left part, then I get my tip, and then I get my right part, and then I get again the real line. So now, how about the future of the curve that I haven't seen here? So that future of the curve, it starts at the tip, and then it bounces to the right part. So it goes somewhere over here, and then it goes off. Which is totally fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It is still a nice curve. With if I do a later time that goes very close here, then this bubble is going to be very, very, very small. And what is important for the continuity is sort of that what you see here really is, well, there's a technical condition that I don't want to see, but it's sort of, it looks small after you took one conformal map. The difference between two consecutive domains should be very small, but not in the Euclidean metric, but in the sort of conformal geometry of the corresponding domain. So this is totally fine. So if we have a curve that bounces off itself, that is fine. But here's an example for something that is not admissible. So if I had a curve itself, a transversal intersection. This is a perfectly nice continuous function, very smooth. But now if I do the same thing, so I pull down only part of it. So again, we have the right and the left. And at that time, the future of the curve is going to go, first it goes to the right, but it comes out and comes out on the left. So it goes like this. And here you see a discontinuity. And in fact, the Leuven equation makes a total sense. It is very easy to prove that you still have this equation here. The only problem is that this function is not continuous anymore. It has a jump. It has only one jump. Actually, it's a very, very, you can generalize that very much. This function, essentially all you need is that this is a measurable function for this to make sense. And even more so, there's, if you allow growth, you can grow whole continua. It's like, I don't want to write it down to spend more time on it, but one function really means only that the domains grow only at one point. So if you want to have a whole, like in Healy-Shaw, a whole boundary that grows, yeah, that is also possibly easy to describe with the Leuven equation. But then you wouldn't just have a point here. Maybe I'll just write it. Then you have a measured distribution, so you would then have you write it like this. Minus x, you integrate over the real line, and you have a measure mu depending on t of x that describes the strength of the growth out of different points. So our case is a very special case where this measure is actually the direct mass at the point wt. Then we come back to the old formula. But if this is a continuous measure, then you have a whole layer that is growing. If you have an atomic measure with a few atoms, then a few slits are growing at the same time. So that equation is very, very general. But we deal only, fortunately, in a sense, with the easiest case. So that is not admissible. But here's another interesting case that is admissible, though it doesn't look like it. It looks much, much worse than that. Oh, what I mean is that the function wt is continuous. And so here's one that is a bit unfortunate. So now if I have let's suppose you have a, it shouldn't be a disk, your favorite shape. But let's take a disk in case you like. Let's see. And now form a spiral, a logarithmic spiral that goes around, it's not logarithmic, a spiral that spirals around it infinitely often. So my curve is actually this. It goes around, spirals around infinitely often. And so it sort of never ends. Yeah, but if it would end, then it starts going out again. So the way to think of it is that you have a logarithmic spiral, for instance, in the plane, which does end. And now you just blow up that point and make it a disk. Okay. It's easy to write a formula down, a homeomorphism.
Say
again? Well, it depends on, that's two, let's say it's two. It's a logarithmic spiral and then the rotation by 180 degrees or so. It's easy to write down the formula, a homeomorphism of the plane that and then it's the image of the real line. Anyway, so that's my my thing. And here we see what the curve is much better. So here the curve is just the portion. I go up to a certain finite time, and then I map that over with this, blowing up that point map. So I get before the time that corresponds to the time here when I'm at the very center, I have a nice curve. You know, that is a smooth curve. But if I take a later time where I went through that infinite spiral and then back out again, of course, on the image side, I got that infinite winding, wind out, and go all the way up to here. The point is that this set is always still a connected set, compact connected, so the complement is simply connected, and that continuity assumption that guarantees that this W here is continuous, the change from one domain to the next is actually very, very small. So that corresponds to a continuous driving term. And from the mathematicians, the analyst's point of view, the sad story is that this map is more continuous than Brownian motion. So Brownian motion has a certain regularity, and Brownian motion is less regular than this WT. So if you work mathematically with Brownian motion, you have to accept that this
probably is differentiable most times.
Oh, yeah, this you can make. Of course, whenever you have every analytic portion corresponds to an analytic one. But it has actually a very precise singularity of the square root type, sort of. Yeah. All right. So now I really want to pick up the speed. So now I need to say something. So far we have discussed how a curve in the plane gives me a real valued function, right? There's just the image of the tip under the conformal map. So we went this way. Now I want to go the other way around. So now I start with a real valued function and I want to describe a curve. So now conversely, so now given such a function WT which is continuous, what I can do is now I just run that ODE. So I can look at it. So I run, let's say that ODE Z dot is 2 over Z minus WT. It's an ODE with a, say, initial condition Z of naught is some point Z. They start at the half plane at a point Z. Here's a singularity WT, that is, T is moving around. So you look at the motion of this point under that flow and take the time T map. So GT of Z is the time T map of this flow. So I guess, I mean, that's the way I think of it. You take a point, you let it run according to that, and then you look where it ended after T time steps. So it's sort of, I mean, it's very, very easy to see. If you're straight above the singularity, so what are the flow lines? Your points are direct vertically down. And the closer you are, so the smaller Z minus W is, one over that is very large, so it picks up speed, so they actually get very, very fast. When you're to the right, points flow to the right. When you're to the left, points flow to the left. So whenever you have a point in the upper half plane which doesn't sit above it, it sort of even escapes from that singularity. So it should extend forever. There's a few unlucky points that sort of get sucked into the singularity. If this one wouldn't move, these points, because the speed picks up, they get killed in finite time. So if you don't like the way I think of it, then just write it down as it's an equation for a map, right? Like this. The time derivative is equal to that. Okay, and then it is actually a very easy fact that this time T map is a conformal map on the set of those points that survived up to time T. So, a few points, think of a constant at first. The constant function sucks in a few points. The longer you wait, the larger it is. It's going to be a vertical interval, obviously, but all the other points survive. So there's a set of killed points. But on the complement of that, this map is a conformal map onto the half plane. So it's conformal and even has the right hydrodynamic normalization at infinity. It's already normalized. So this is the set of points that are killed that fall into the singularity where the ODE doesn't make any sense up to time t, at some point t or earlier. And so this is actually, again, another very simple exercise. The main tool here is the existence and uniqueness theorem for ODEs. So if I take two different points, they will never collide, because if they would collide, then running the equation backwards, they would have to separate, and so on. And then this kernel here, 2 over z minus w, is analytic in z, so the solution is going to be an analytic function. So you get analytic injective functions. You need to prove the ontoness. And again, the ontoness is by flowing backwards. If you have a point in the half-plane, you flow the equation backwards, you get the pre-image. Backwards flowing is always nice, because you always flow upwards, you never flow. There's only one singularity, which is here. So this is all very soft. All right, so what is this set here, KT? Well, I mean, because the rest is conforming up to that, this is some compact set, and I think the only thing that is trivial to say here is that this is an increasing set. At t equals 0, we haven't done anything, so it's the empty set, and then it is increasing. Right, the more time you let pass, the more points get killed. The ones that are already dead stay dead. And actually, I always added as a trivial fact that this set is non-empty, but I'm not convinced anymore that this is trivial. It's very simple to prove, but I think it's not quite trivial because it's false in higher dimensions. So, I mean, the proof of it is, what is the proof?
So
yeah, I'll say that in a second. Let's just prove why is it non-empty. Yeah. So if it were empty, then I hadn't removed anything here, so I have the identity. I have the identity, but the identity has in its normalization a zero here. But you compute and show that from that equation you have a 2t there, so it's not the identity, so there is something. Now how about on higher dimensions? So you have the two-dimensional plane, and I mean that was one of the models that Odette and I, we discussed that a little bit. What would happen if you have a two-dimensional continuous function, say? And the equation you could take is, so say, between 0 and the... I mean, you want to see how a point in upper half space would move. You know? And you just look at the sort of the plane that is between that point and your driving term on the plane. And then just the plane perpendicular to your bounding plane. And in that plane, you just take exactly that equation. So that describes you the flow line. You can write it. Or just a two-dimensional function on the plane that is moving around continuously. Oh, I just want to describe the flow lines. How would a point in the upper half space move, given that point in the real? So if you take that... Well, let's talk about that in a break. But anyway, the natural thing to do is it's easier to describe than write on a formula. You know? And there it is possible to have continuous functions that don't kill any points. So just, you know, it sort of can escape. Because in two dimensions, that driving term could sort of walk. I mean, if it moves fast away, it wouldn't kill anything. So anyway, what I want to say, even the trivial facts are maybe not totally trivial. You know? So that's what makes it a bit tedious. If you take a totally mathematically rigorous approach and want to prove everything, this needs proof. And I mentioned the proof. It's very simple. But there are other simple facts, too. Okay. All right. So now I should... But anyway, if we accept this as this is just a set, increasing set, so if we call that curve, then we now get, from a continuous function W, we get some sort of curve. And we see already from this example here, if we had taken this example to begin with to create my function W, stick that into the Leibniz equation, I get this thing back. Okay. But what is the curve really? What is the set of killed points in this picture here? The set of killed points is not just the outer boundary, because then the complement wouldn't be simply connected, right? I mean, you see, at the point where I have seen this part, the complement does not contain this thing. So the hull itself, at the time corresponding to this point, is going to be everything, the sort of curve together with the loops filled in. Okay? Does that make sense? This is a bit hard to follow. So what I want to say, even if there is a sort of a curve in the background, lurking in the background, if you just look at that function WT that describes this, run the Loebner equation, you get the set KT of killed points, you will not see exactly the curve, but you see the curve with all the holes, with all the bubbles filled in. Okay? There, exactly, yeah. So KT is, so let's put it a bit in quotation. So KT is the set gamma. I mean, there is a sort of a curve, and together with everything that gets surrounded by it. Okay.
So before you reach that point, you don't get the bubble. The moment you reach that point, you get a full bubble.
Exactly. You're right. So that is in the Euclidean metric. You're absolutely right. From the Euclidean eye, these guys are terribly discontinuous. You're absolutely right. So at that time, before the bubble, your KT looks like this. Okay, and at the time it hits, KT is this. So in the Hausdorff metric, it's a totally discontinuous object. Yeah? But of course, in the conformal metric, I mean, the difference, let's see. I mean, what does, if I map this one to the plane, then the future of the curve, this little piece here, see, this gets mapped, I mean, the size of it, it's like a harmonic measure thing. So seen from up here, the hitting probability of the red before the white is very, very small. So this corresponds to a really teeny tiny thing. So the difference, in a sense, you should view the difference between the domain before hitting and after hitting, the difference in the sort of conformal metric, which is the natural geometry is over here. And that's a very, very small difference. So it is continuous in that conformal world, but it's discontinuous for the Euclidean eye. That's exactly what happens here, but here it's harder to draw a picture.
For this kind of thing, there are explicit examples, very clear examples, where you can just have all the mapping explicitly. All the time.
Yeah, this is the next thanks for. So I should maybe mention that, and then we should have a quick break. I should. So there are a few explicit calculations, and one was done by Ilya and Leo Kardanov. So I should give a couple of examples. So if my function WT is a constant, then that's the obvious example, right? I mean, so here we get a vertical slit, and it's growing with time t, and the height, as you can write down, that it's a very, very simple thing to solve. Even mathematicians can do that. And so the height, then the tip is actually here, for instance, is at 2i square root of t. So that's an easy case. The next easiest case is a square root function. For a reason that I'll explain in a second, this function is also easy. And here, the slit is a line, a line segment. And the angle just depends on the constant. Constant zero is vertical. When as a constant goes to infinity, the angle goes to zero. Okay. There is a neat argument. This can be computed, but it can also be done by pure thought. And I should. Like, because that's an important property, that if you do Brownian scaling on this function, so if you form a new function, which is you scale by r the square inside, so r squared t, and then by 1 over r outside. So if you take a Brownian motion, you would get another Brownian motion. How do the Hults transform? It's a very simple exercise from the equation that the Hults corresponding to this function are just the rescaled Hults of this one. So they're 1 over r, k of r squared t. So, if I take a function, I do Brownian scaling, I get a new function, I run the Loebner equation, I get new halts. But the new halts are up to a time change, because this is just, think of t varying and r being fixed, then this is just a scaling of the old halts. So now you have a compact set, and even if you wouldn't know that, it's a line segment, but if it's invariant under scaling, there aren't too many choices. So, okay, so that's another example. And then there's a more interesting example, which goes like this. If WT is, now it's again a square root singularity, but now you run into it, not away from it, sort of, but into it. So it's just square root of 1 minus t, and let's say on the interval 0, 1.
Brownian scaling is sort of essentially, it's property of the equation. It's the equation that's consistent with this.
Right? Exactly, you're absolutely right. So if you have this function like this, now it looks sort of, different, because what happens, of course, for zero, again, we have the vertical one. For small values of c, what you see is a curve. So these are all calculations that were actually performed explicitly also by Leo and Ilya. But, So you get a curve which sort of logarithmic spiral at the very top. You have to look hard, but it's an infinite spiral at the very, very top. The larger C gets, the more it sort of, you know, the better visible that spiral becomes. And you sort of can also see, almost with that same scaling argument, that something self-similar has to happen at the tip, asymptotically, but anyway. But then at a critical point, when C equals 4, it turns out that this curve actually hits, so this is C equals 4, this curve hits the real line before it sits inside the upper half plane, and then we do have where we just discussed the discontinuity. Yeah, at t equals 1. So this function, you could, if you wanted to, continue to be a continuous function afterwards, right? If you really want to have a continuous function for all values of t, you have up to time t equals 1 this, and then you continue with a constant function. Then you would see exactly this. The hitting here happens at time t equals 1, and then... Oh, it's always t equals 1. I mean, the only singularity here is at t equals 1.
T equals 1 is the end of the...
The end of that spiral is always at t equals 1. Whenever your function is smooth, the curve is smooth. Okay, I mean...
Where does it hit on the real axis?
This I don't know. I mean, this is you have computed it, I guess.
Just some number.
Yeah. But then as C increases, you will still I draw one more picture. So as C increases, you still have a hitting. That angle, which is 0 degrees at 4, becomes larger and larger, and eventually goes from 0 to all the way to pi as c goes to infinity.
Is c over the student? I was not involved in this.
Oh yeah, you're right. You are not in, yeah. And I mean, this is a computation, but on the other hand, it's a useful one.
What kind of functions come into this?
So they study all kind of power ways. Essentially, they study t to the power of beta.
Not just that, this is an analytic solution.
Yeah, it's an analytic solution.
In terms of what kind of function?
They're not quite explicit in the sense that they have some explicit functions, but implicit. It's an implicit solutions of some equations. You have some algebraic equations containing functions, and you cannot solve explicitly. Yeah. But the functions involved are explicit functions. Well, it's like you can't solve fifth order equation explicitly, right?
And
that's
the
graphic.
And the functions involved are?
I don't remember.
But anyway, this sort of shows that the power laws, I mean, the only interesting case is really the exponent 1/2. If it is worse than 1/2, then you have no sort of control. Already at 1/2, you get a bad behavior. And in a sense, this one here also obeys, this function corresponding to that is almost exactly the same function as that 4 times square root 1 minus t. It's a teeny tiny perturbation. It's anyway. So now I would like to mention one mathematical result that has been proved just for the question: when can you be sure that you have curves and not a? This is not too bad a behavior, but it can be hardly distinguished from that one. So when can you be sure that you don't have such things? And here the theorem is. Maybe I should use that. So if your function. So if that function wt behaves basically at everywhere like constant times square root t minus f, and so for all t and s, and if that constant c is less than 4, then you can be certain that kt is really a nice curve. It is a simple curve, no loops in the upper half plane. And if that c is larger than 4, then you have no control whatsoever anymore. Then this can already happen. So this is a very clear cutoff. Now, for a mathematician, this is this is an illustration of it. But this has a much more. I mean, it's a huge amount of flexibility. So here,
it's more regular. It's bounded by Gaussian motion with some string.
Sorry. Say again. Brownian motion is worse. Brownian motion, unfortunately, does not satisfy this.
No, but I think it's cup equals 4 is exactly this C equals 4. It's the same story.
But this I've tried to, I mean, that these kappas are the same, that this 4 is the equal to the 4. Of course, I mean, it's numerology.
I'm saying the transition in SLE
exactly.
Having 4 is, I think it's the same thing as here.
Yeah, but I don't know a formal proof.
But Brownian motion doesn't satisfy this. So
exactly. So you cannot use that. There is no mathematical way to make that rigorous. And I've thought about that quite a bit. I would love to see it. At this point, the only thing I can prove is that the 4 and the 16 are the same, but that's not a... Anyway, so for a mathematician, this is...
So, is this Brownian motion where delta W is a order?
Yeah, but on the average, you're right. So the typical behavior is like that. But the extreme behavior for Brownian motion is that you have an extra term. So you have a C times square root of T minus S. Let's take just WT, Brownian motion, WT. And then it behaves like square root of T times log 1 over T. The law of iterated logarithms says that if you take that ratio and you take the maximal choice as T goes to 0 or to infinity, so locally you have fluctuations this big. So the constant can be as large as log 1 over T, which is unbounded. But you have so many cancellations from the oscillations that things still work out nicely. But unfortunately, this deterministic result does not work. And that's anyway, the history here is Don Marshall, and I proved that with some constant C, and then my student Joan Lynch, she proved that C is actually equal to 4. But that is... So I think now it's time we should have some break. So maybe, and after that break, I should pick up the speed. And then I put the S into the LE. So this is just the Leuven equation. We have a 5-minute break, I guess. Okay, so maybe before I actually use it, I haven't given the definition of SLE, but I'll write it down in a second anyway, and we all know it. But what the definition is in a nutshell is we just discussed the curve corresponds to a real valued function. If I take a real valued function, then I get a curve, which isn't necessarily a curve in the strict sense, it could have bubbles or so here, but I get some growing sets. And SLE is what I get from the Leuven equation if I put in Brownian motion. And the speed of the Brownian motion I can adjust. So that's the parameter. The SLE is, I guess we could say it's LE with a WT being square root of kappa times BT. BT is one-dimensional Brownian motion, kappa is a real number, square root of kappa is a real number, so I have certain speed. Growing motion. So I expect to see some growing sets if I run it the way I described it. But now to understand what the problem, what you're going to see is actually, let's go back to this little sort of movie here. Because if I let that equation run for a certain time, then in the end I will see a curve. Okay? And now if I view that curve as how it came from, so I could view it as unraveling it from the top. Then I would see something boring. I see there's a curve and it sort of unravels. Okay, but I could also see it sort of unraveling from the bottom when I see something more interesting. Then I see at actually that bottom point moving, that driving term. So if I think of, I have that SLE curve and I unravel it from the bottom, just like in this picture. So what I would see then is at the bottom here on the real line, the point that I see moving a one-dimensional Brownian motion. Okay. So now this can be reversed and made an algorithm where I just start with a half plane and now I just put little instead of, you know, there is a simple way to view this as a composition of certain conformal maps. And so what you will see in that sort of movie is this growing slit here. And at the bottom, because I'm a poor programmer, I haven't spent time on putting there, you won't see the line, for instance. You just see the base of the curve. So you see the wiggliness there and a growing curve. So that this curve is going to change is due to that we see the movie sort of the other way around. So let's start with a small value of kappa, maybe even a 0.1. At 0, and then I say draw SLE. So yeah, so here's the real line, okay? So here you see the Brownian motion, square root of 0.1 times BT moving, and that is that curve. And you see it's almost straight. If I had taken 0, I would see a vertical one. So let's take a larger value. Maybe here this here. Now let's take the value 1. Now you see, the Brownian motion is moving fast at this speed. 1 times BT, and the curve gets wigglier. And as I increase it, unfortunately, as I said, if we take another one, of course it's a random curve, so I should maybe... I will get another curve, but it has the same sort of fractal quality. I leave the previous one. Usually it overlaps a bit, so here are two instances of that. Now if I took a yet larger number, let's take the interesting one, 6. So now unfortunately it is quite likely. Now you see it moves really fast, and the curve you get doesn't really... it is piecewise smooth, and this the reason is that we have only a few steps, 500 points. Yeah. So if we took many, many, many more points, what you would actually see is, by definition, what the algorithm produces is always going to be a simple curve, because it's a concatenation of arcs just moved about. This cannot not possibly create loops, but in the limit, as the number of steps would go to infinity, it's actually easy to prove that this converges to SLE, so that the curves you get... Well, I should be a bit careful, but... It's not easy to prove, but let's say for kappa less than 4, it's easy to prove that this is going to converge, and so you get the right picture. And so maybe I should put in a little bit a larger number, but you wouldn't see the loops better here. If I take a too large a number, maybe Ilya's computer can do it. A bit more. I had another version which I couldn't get to run on Ilya's computer, where a better algorithm would... Oh, no, unfortunately, all the action happens here, and we... No, maybe I even crashed your computer. Maybe that gives enough of an intuition, yeah? We should leave it at this here. Can I just turn this off? Is that okay?
This is a curve. It's not key, what you're doing there.
Say again?
This is a curve that you're doing there, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. As I said, because there is no... This algorithm cannot produce bubbles. It always will produce a simple curve, right? It is... the bubbles, I'll come to that. The bubbles are there, but you can't see them in that algorithm here.
I would have expected to see more pinches.
Yeah, then you would have to wait longer. Let's do that again then. And maybe let's see... unfortunately, that improved program... I mean, I have a better version of the program. Let's hope that it stays here a bit longer so that... Yet. Well, I mean, here you see a fair amount of pinching already.
The WT is the point on the axis. Right?
WT is still moving around here.
Off the screen. Yeah.
And I have written another version of the program. It's walking out here, unfortunately. Because now the flow lines are reversed. Now the flow lines go up and towards the singularity. So everything here, if the singularity is out here, gets sort of pulled out of the screen.
What if you put in 50,000 points?
Yeah, the problem is the number of... it's going to be quadratic, but the first few are going to be fast. Oh, I think then the computer is probably going to crash. The problem is... No, the bigger kappa will make it within a few steps go out. The way this is computed is exactly that way. In the nth step, we have n points on that curve, and you see a polygon through it. And then the next map, the n plus first map, is applied to these n points. So there are basically n function evaluations in the nth step. So the number of steps it takes, it's the sum from 1 to the total number, 50,000, of n, which is a square. It's basically n squared over 2. So that would take 50,000 squared evaluations of a certain... It's a simple function. Fortunately, this is actually an algebraic function. The one that I use here is but let's try it. I don't know. I've never tried. On my computer, I think, yeah. Oh, I limited it to 10,000. Whoops. Now it's gone. Well, that's plenty for... I think that's... Maybe I have a picture here that... What that really does, and I haven't improved it, as I said, that I didn't... But that first draws it with maybe 1,000 points, and then sees where there are long parts, and sort of where it needs to refine that sampling of the... What it really does, it samples Brownian motion This primitive version doesn't even sample it. It approximates Brownian motion by simple random walk. A better version just samples Brownian motion and then draws a primitive version of that curve and then sees where the distance is large. And there where it's large, you need to sample Brownian motion better. So you put in a Brownian bridge to sample some more and so on. And then you get pretty good pictures pretty quickly. But anyway, let's...
You start with this just a kind of like straight line, so it's little jumps, right?
Say again?
Like a function which has...
That is one version to do. If you would take for these, if you take a piecewise constant approximation, then you get vertical ones that you come in, and then you don't even get a curve. But I have done some piecewise linear. It's not even a linear approximation. I actually take an approximation by a square root function because I compose locally. So what this really does is you just take two conformal maps, the map to this slit and that slit, okay? And you flip a coin. That would be simple random walk. So if you flip a coin, the conformal map from the half plane to this one or to that one, which one to take?
Okay.
And each time you flip a coin, which of the two you take, and you keep composing these maps. This is exactly what you see here.
Okay.
Now, when you run the Loebner equation for that curve that you get, you will, basically, this one gives you a certain drift to the right and this one to the left, and they're symmetric. So you get a, what happens in between is not really linear, it is that square root law, but it doesn't really matter. So at those sample points, you really see the symmetric random walk, the one-dimensional one. And as the mesh size, the limit scaling is done sort of by the picture automatically, you get the Brownian motion by the Donska invariance principle or whatever. And there are many ways to do it, but this is a better way. I mean, doing it the way, I think there are a couple, I've seen that, I think maybe Hastings did that, and also Robert Bauer did that, to approximate it by using vertical slits. That's possible. So that's when you take simple random walk when the graph is piecewise constant, but that doesn't produce, there's no reason to do that. This is the better way, I guess. All right. So maybe then I'll just get this. Well, maybe I don't have to. Everybody, maybe I'll leave the screen right up, but just disconnect the computer, and I just make the definition here. So the Schramm-Loebner evolution. So the Schramm. And now that L usually gets, instead of the umlaut, it gets an OE. And the reason is that Karl Loebner had problems when he moved to the U.S. then in the 30s. And in the U.S., of course, umlaute are bad. A Karl with a K is not so easy. And so he changed his name to Charles Loebner. And so there are these both spellings. But it's the same Loebner, of course. And I understood that he was actually a little bit almost abused. I mean, I think he was at Syracuse grading huge amounts of, just grading. And he still did very good work after, but in a different area. He worked on what is now called Loebner spaces, conformal geometry, quasi-conformal mappings. Anyway, he announced the proof for all K of a Biwa conjecture, but he never gave it. Anyway, so we take that Loebner equation, we put in Brownian motion with that speed squared of kappa, so we get what we call the Schramm-Loebner evolution. And again, so at this point, all we know about it, we are a bit discouraged by that square root behavior that can create topological bad behavior. Brownian motion is not good enough to guarantee that we get curves, so all we get at this point is a growing hulls, growing set of continua. Okay, I mean, that's all you can say without any further notice. And I'll explain theorems that tell you more about it. Okay, so I should mention that this was first called Odette, of course, didn't call it like this. He called it the stochastic Loebner evolution. And that was later, of course, changed. Maybe Wendelin admitted that to the Schramm-Loebner evolution, of course, appreciation of his contribution. And I want to present one piece of historical, that's actually a very curious historical thing, that the name stochastic Loebner equation was used, when do you think was it used the first time? Maybe it's pedagogical, so I should ask us a quiz. No, maybe if we can turn this one off. The name stochastic Loebner equation. Odette's paper was, I think this is from 99. I mean, in 98 he told me about sort of pre-ideas. Anyway, in 1990 or 89, I'm not 100% certain, there was some people working on something related to DLA. I'll show a picture later. They found they wanted to approximate DLA by composing conformal maps from a disk to a slit disk. Back then there were not, my advisor Pomeranke, he also was interested in that, and he told me about that in, I think, in 89. Back then people couldn't really prove maybe good theorems about it, so there is not much of a trace in the literature. But there is one talk that was given at a sectional meeting at an AMS by Richard Rockberg from St. Louis and his son, where the title is Stochastic Loebner Equation, but it's a different. It's growing continua that are randomly growing, so the Loebner equation.
Loebner Hastings essentially.
And actually, it's the same what is now called the Hastings-Levitov process. Just it was a bit earlier, but I mean, Hastings-Levitov I think was 98, and this was about 89.
Oh,
but, I mean, it's. But the problem is that whole idea of, I mean, the DLA is a fascinating process. It's, of course, I mean, that is obvious, especially because it's so notoriously difficult to say anything about it besides Kasten's result. There isn't really the rigorous results. And in 91, when I first met with that, I mean, I mentioned that DLA, we chatted quite a bit about it, and being very optimistic, said, well, it ought to be possible to prove something. We discussed that quite a bit, but it was, I guess, it's still not anything that can really be said. So mathematicians, then, including, I mean, like Leonard Carlson and Nick Makarov, they wrote a paper of a model that is similar, but it is still simplifying even. And Peter Jones was sort of promoting it, but these things were always just asked as a sort of oral communication. And okay, anyway, so that was one of these folklore things that was around for a very, very different problem, to use compositions of conformal maps. All right, so SLE, we sort of defined it. We defined it only in a half plane, but if we have SLE, if we want to define it in any simply connected domain, so what we would do, we need two marked boundary points. There are other versions, but let's say we have a domain D and two boundary points A and B. And then SLE produces a sequence of later with it. So there is a curve that starts from A and ends at B and sits entirely inside the closure of D. It can hit the boundary, as we'll see later. And so how would we define it there? Well, we could use the same equation, or we just compose with a conformal map to the half plane that sends A to zero and B to the point at infinity. And then we run that SLE as I defined it, which produces something starting at zero going off to infinity. And we just transport it back conformally, this conformal map. You should worry about the scaling here, but this is scaling invariant. But what I mentioned before, the Brownian scaling here, means that at least if I don't care about the speed with which I run through these curves, so that speed change here, which is just a factor, then I will see the same evolution here. So mapping it over, it doesn't quite matter even how I normalize. I have only used two parameters, so the third one, the scaling, sort of doesn't matter. Well, depending on the question. So now I would like to show a few pictures. No, maybe I shouldn't show pictures at that point. Maybe I should just say, why does SLE appear naturally? So I want to speak about the conformal Markov property. I mean, of course, that just didn't go out and say, okay, let's take Loebner equation and plug in Brownian motion. In fact, this is another interesting maybe piece of, I mean, this is totally, but to me, I found a curious piece of information history. But my advisor, Pomeranke, who is a well-known complex analyst conformal mapper, and he is one of the, or one, was one of the sort of more leading expert knowledge about the Loebner equation. Part of what I didn't quite explain, you know, continuity question, these were things he was doing. Brandon's Bieber-Bach conjecture he was very involved in. And I never was interested in the Loebner equation at all. I sort of disliked it. But at some point over coffee, also in the late 80s, he sort of made that suggestion. I mean, for some reason, analysts would be very interested in finding random domains to solve some problems of their interest, like the average or the integral means average growth of derivatives. And some questions are very important within analysis. And like in many branches of mathematics now, if you can't produce a single example that serves your purpose, produce a whole family of examples, like a random family, and you know, take the average and use sort of Fubini's theorem. So if you can prove that there's a large class of examples,
it's sometimes easier
to produce a large class than a single one. I guess I'm not very coherent here, but that's a principle that is very... There are many, many theorems in mathematics where you cannot put down your finger on a single example, but you can produce a whole class of random class of examples where almost every example actually does that. And so it's a natural idea to look at random conformal maps, random domains. I do remember that Pomerank at some point suggested, you know, how to produce random domains. Complex dynamics gives some semi-random, but not good enough for purposes. And he even mentioned once, well, what would happen if you put Brownian motion into Loebner equation? He said, maybe it should produce some sort of random curve, but there was no clue whatsoever why that should be interesting, how to deal with that. So that was not what Odette did. So Odette came up with SLE very naturally. He looked at a natural problem, and it led to the Loebner equation, and it led to the Brownian motion. So that's the right approach. So that came out meaningful. So let's talk about the conformal Markov property. And I want to do it So let's suppose we have random curves, and those should come out of maybe physically meaningful situations. So suppose we have a measure P on curves in a domain D from A to B. Measure on curves in some domain D from A to B. And later we will see many examples of that, but a typical example is, of course, percolation exploration is maybe the prime example where you can see things. Let's still maybe think about the half plane here. And so you have a curve that starts at zero, goes off to infinity. But you can do that in any domain. But other choices are self-avoiding walks. So you take all self-avoiding. Let's suppose maybe it's a finite domain, a finite graph. And then you want to pass to a limit. So you take a self-avoiding walks, all simple lattice path from one boundary point A to another boundary point B with a uniform measure, or loop erased walks. I mean, there are many, many ways to create simple lattice paths from A to B, and then a scaling limit, if it exists, is often exhibits that conformal Markov property. So what is a conformal Markov property? Well, there should first be that conformal invariance. Which should mean this. So here I have one domain D, the points A, B, and this probability distribution for curves for A to B. And then I take another simply connected domain D prime with two points A prime, B prime. And now there is a conformal map mapping D to D prime and A to A prime, B to B prime. Let's call this one F. And then conformal invariance would just require that the probability measure here gets just transported to the probability measure of the curves over here. Right? So let's call it like F. Apply to the push forward of that measure B, D, A, B. It's just a measure in that image domain from A prime to B prime. So that's just the conformal invariance. And that's experimentally observed.
It's just a definition, right?
That is a definition. So I just try to explain what is the conformal Markov property. So I assume I have a family of measures.
It's not what we would call conformal invariance in physics.
Say again?
It's not what we would call conformal invariance in physics.
Oh, I see. Yeah, what would you call it?
In physics, you would want to have, let's say, Ising model here, with its marked points, compare the ensembles, and then you would say, this curve has some probability here, has some probability here. And then, if they happen to be conformal images of each other, you call conformal invariance.
That's what this is.
No, the measure on the left is defined in some way, and I just transport it. I have an intrinsic definition of the measure on two domains in my definition.
No, so it's
but that's what we have here, PD and PD prime.
It's the same measure.
I thought it was a definition of how you define it on the right. Sorry, maybe I'm confused.
For every D, A, B, there's a P.
So, which is intrinsic.
I think, I mean, a good way to think of it is maybe...
So like a Brownian motion or self-aware motion, right?
Maybe this one. If you have a domain, if you have a domain, like our rectangle.
I think we agree.
I mean, of course, you can then, once you make that assumption, you can work with one standard domain, a disk or the half plane. You can also have a marked point, a boundary point, and an interior point. Then the disk is more natural. You get that radial Lyman equation. This is the caudal one. And one way to think of it is to fix your domain like a half plane and then have different letters as one's your standard, for instance, Z2 letters, and the other one a conformal image of a Z2 one. So that's the conformal invariance. Then there's that Markov property. We should think of like this. So we have our two points A and B, and our random curve. And now suppose we take one of these curves. Of course, mathematically expressing that in the continuous setting requires the notation of filtrations and conditional expectations or conditional. But if you think of a simple path, then it's very easy to. So think of a simple path, maybe. Then there's only finitely many ones anyway, and then there's no problem. And suppose we take one of these and we run it for a certain amount only a part of it. That curve. And we fix that curve, and now we look at all possible continuations on that curve. So maybe I should call this, let me stick to my notation, because I always find it a bit... All right, so I have to, let's call this portion of the curve, say, gamma naught. The full curve is maybe called gamma. And then I want to call this point maybe A naught, and then the way I want to write it down is the law of these curves, but restricted to have that initial curve. So the law to go in D from A to B, sort of given that it starts with that piece gamma naught, now I could do the same, and now I could say, well, I look at the different domain D prime, which is that original domain with that arc gamma naught removed. So D minus gamma naught, and now I want to continue the path just from here to here, A naught to B. And if it happens sort of to be that, I mean, why Markov property? So the way you should read it, we have that curve that somehow evolves, and they do not always come out of evolution, so that the interface is not really, but somehow think of going from here to here. And then this is the future of the path, and this is the past, and sort of having this one is the present. And then it is sort of the Markov property, right? That the future of the path is sort of independent of how we got there. I mean, that is the Markov property.
But the domain, of course, depends on how we get there.
Well, this domain, I mean, the domain D is fixed, right? But of course. Yeah, this domain is, of course, I mean, it is the domain, the original one minus what I got. Okay. And so I guess what is the Schramm's principle is to say, if we have such a family of curves with that Markov property, it is automatically, this is exactly what SLE is. So if you have that, it's sort of easy to prove, and I'll show that this is exactly what SLE is. So then, now I want to explain very briefly, and that's very simple, that this is exactly SLE. And then I want to give some examples, some pictures of processes where you actually have these properties. Usually it turns out the Markov property is, in many of the processes, is very easy. It's almost built into the process. And the conformal invariance is really the hard part. Okay, but so let's first see, what should we think of that? Well, by conformal invariance, we can anyway always normalize that one domain to be the half plane. So let's just start with a half plane curves from 0 to infinity. So we have such a curve gamma. And what I'm saying now, when I'm saying that this is SLD, what I'm really saying is, so I sample a curve from 0 to infinity, and once I have that curve, I run that Loebner equation. So I understand that curve by means of the Loebner equation. So I get the driving term W sub t. And what I need to prove now is that this function is a random function. It's actually Brownian motion. Right, that's exactly what SLE is. Okay, so I take a random curve, gamma, according to that law. Maybe I should write here p h from 0 to infinity. And I want to understand its driving term. So what I have to do to understand it, I have to pick a point on it and map that portion of the curve. I mean, let's call this curve. Now we reparameterize as we did before, so we have a point gamma t on the curve. And we apply the conformal map g sub t from the complement, that portion, down to the real line. So the tip here goes to that real valued number W sub t. And I want to show W sub t is Brownian motion. So the way to do that is, I mean, we should, of course, I mean, we will use some Brownian motion characterization. And so one thing is built into that definition is already that this thing is a curve. And so the WT is continuous, which is a very, very important, I mean, technically important assumption, or you need to prove it. WT is continuous. This comes out of the assumption that my curve is actually a curve. And that has been done, I think, by Eisenman and Borchardt. In many situations, we know sort of also rigorously that this happens in the limits of many systems. Okay, so now I want to say something about, I want to say that this is a continuous Levy process, and then I know it's Brownian motion, and up to a drift. So I want to say something about the increments, how WT changes as I change from one time to another. So I need to look at another time. So I look at the time, say S. So here's my curve gamma. Now I take a point on the curve gamma of S. And so I get that new piece of curve here. I mean, that's a bit of the future. And this piece gets mapped by GT to some piece over here at first. That's one thing I can do. Or another thing I could do, I could take that whole curve from 0 up to time s and flatten out the whole piece at once. Maybe I should do that. This picture here. So I take the conformal map from the half plane minus everything up to time s to the half plane, and the bottom I see these red pieces, and finally I opened up that green piece, and now the tip here goes to the point w sub s. All right, so let's see. So now we're almost done. Now we just have to look at it in the right way. All right, so the conformal invariance. Well, no, I guess we should maybe start with that restriction, with that Markov property. So I guess what I should first like to say is that this piece of curve here is, by the conformal Markov property, is still distributed according to my law. It's just the future of the curve, and if I condition on this part from here to gamma of t, so I fix that part from here to gamma of t, so let's say given gamma of t. So this we think of being fixed, so the g sub t is fixed for a moment, then the law of this curve over here is just exactly, and that green part corresponds to this in the future. So this is still distributed according to my measure. So this one is distributed according to the probability in the half space, and now from Wt to infinity. Well, yeah. So, yeah. Let's be. I use that Markov property that the future here has really the law of within this slit domain from here to infinity. And then I apply that conformal map to the other way around, yeah, to just to say that the law of the green curve here from here to infinity is the same as the law in here from here to infinity. So this is where I use the conformal invariance, and this is where I use the Markov property. So I use both properties in a very...
This Markov property would be absolutely not useful without conformal.
That's correct. And in fact, Markov property itself works even off the critical points. Just take as a model off the critical point, it will still work. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Now this one has. Let's see. So now what we would like to say, maybe we should just, so that we get the same system where it goes from zero to infinity. So I could just also subtract. Well, I guess what I should like to say, because these curves are distributed according to that, at least once I subtracted the. Well, let's just look at its Loebner driving term. Okay. So I run this curve up to a certain time, and then I conformally need to map the complement of that curve to the half plane. But this conformal map is already written down here, right? The map from the complement of that slit to the half plane is just a composition of these two maps. So the tip here, which corresponds to the Loebner driving term for that curve here, is equal to Ws. And so, now I would rather like to, just in this picture here, I would like this to start when this is small at zero, so I just translate by W sub t. T is fixed, Wt is fixed. So, let's see, I'm confusing myself a little bit. This driving term here is exactly, so what I want to say, the driving term for this curve here is, let's write it out, and driving term is equal to Wt minus Ws minus Wt. Well, it depends on how we. Not really, huh? I mean.
Your real map is the shift by Wt. You should start with zero.
Exactly, but I have to. If I take this function, then of course only for s greater than or equal to t, I will get a curve that starts out at zero. Right. So you're right. I mean, this curve, I mean, if I take...
The result you want to get is that this has the same law as w of both s minus t.
Exactly, yeah. So the time parameter for that curve here is, I mean, sort of the capacity. This is one little thing that we actually didn't discuss, but that they're additive. This is also what you need. So when I compose... So the capacity, the total time here, capacity of this thing is s. And it breaks down as t plus s minus t. So when I conformally map this one down, that this one still has capacity s minus t. So that curve here is a curve that starts at height 0, capacity 0, and capacity moves up. And that the capacity of that piece is exactly s minus t. And that's a very, very simple thing. The capacity was just that sort of that first coefficient in the series development at infinity. So what you only need to see here is when you compose two of these terms at infinity, that the first coefficient is additive. In the radial model, it would be the derivative at zero, which then by chain rule would be multiplicative. That's where things look a bit. Same thing. So at infinity, the coefficients are. So the driving term. So here, so the driving term for this, let's call it W. But it's W twiddle for this curve. Let's call it W twiddle. T minus S is S minus T. Is equal to W S minus W T. Now here it is. That's why I put the twiddle. That is really the driving term of this particular curve. And so we assume it has the same law as this one has the same law as the original curve. So it has the same law as a W S minus T. So the law of W S minus W T is. The same law as the one of W S minus T. But in particular, the main thing that you only need from that is that the law of W S minus T does not depend on the path, so on the interval from 0 to T, and is independent of S minus independent of, depends only on S minus T, on that number. And then you can say, so you have a Levy process with these independent increments, and they are characterized. Basically, you look at the characteristic function. There's a quadratic term that corresponds to the Brownian motion part. It has a linear term which corresponds to drift, and it has a jump part which corresponds to sort of to discontinuities. And Levy's theorem is that the continuous Levy processes are Brownian motion at a certain speed plus some drift. There is some constant times Brownian motion plus some linear term. And the linear term we don't have here because, I mean, we could just take expectations and see that this is symmetric with respect to the imagine.
An extra assumption, actually.
Yeah, you're right. I guess...
Scale invariance.
We have the scale invariance we could use.
The invariance under conformal automorphism to the domain that fits A and B.
Exactly. I guess if we scale by... I mean, do that sort of Brownian scaling. This term scales, right? But this one wouldn't. So it only works when alpha is zero.
Well, it could be a parameter in the model of the right dimensions.
Usually...
Maybe...
Usually when you say this conformal invariance, you mean that it holds for any conformal map?
Yes, if you take the orientation reversing one.
In particular, that implies it's a very underconformal map from E to itself. It fixes A and B.
Well, that's fine. It depends if you want to just consider conformal maps continuously connected to the identity or the reflection, which is not. That's the question. I mean, it's a question within the particular lattice model that you're trying to apply this to, whether you actually have this reflection property or not.
But you don't get reflection here, just dilation.
You think it's just done?
Just
scale it down.
Well, in this formulation, I guess there is a slight problem also. Maybe I haven't quite. We should sort of have those with the right parameterization, and then with a fixed time t, for instance, and then you have the scale invariance built in. But maybe you can if you just were to look at the whole curve at once, then I'm not sure. Maybe then you can get away without the scale invariance, and then you're right, and it could be a parameter. Anyway, so here we would see from the scaling invariance that this is a.
Is that not what would be an example of absence of this symmetry? How you make it more favorable to go?
Oh,
You get this in certain Gaussian free field constructions. It can, instead of taking level lines with plus minus lambda boundary conditions, you take level lines with plus minus boundary plus a linear function. That's every linear function is zero on the real line, and it's linearly increasing as you go up. Then you expect the level line of this to be to have these Markov properties, but not to be scale invariant. So then you would get the alpha being non-zero.
I think,
but usually scale invariance is such a natural part of the model for almost any model that.
I mean, you could do a stupid thing, sort of. I think you could just say set C equals zero, right? I mean, which is a SLE kappa, which is normally give you the vertical slit, which gives you in the domain the geodesic between A and T. So there is no randomness, but still, it's a curve. Right? With that one, you would also get a curve. It's a well-defined curve. It's not a geodesic anymore. It goes from zero to infinity. In the half plane, that one looks like this. Yeah. And you're right. I mean, then you have a compounded transported, and you would get that. But the scale invariance is not working. That it is sort of the formulation sort of built in if they take that natural parameter. Or you use really conformal invariance in the strict sense, where you have also the anti-homomorphic conformal map. Then you really get the symmetry. But you're right, else you would have to this is obviously not symmetric. We have just one curve to the side.
I mean, this is a pretty strong statement then, that the scale invariance or the conformal invariance implies that you also have the Pest symmetry.
I mean,
on the lattice in like the FK models, this symmetry follows because of duality or something for the RC model. But you can think of other models which are not sub-dual also thinking.
It will be obvious on the lattice anyway.
Okay, sorry, maybe we should discuss this one.
Yeah, I see. I'm actually sort of, I got about a quarter of what I want to say, but I'm already out of time, so maybe I should just flash some. This is what you know better anyway. Now, this discussion basically is done then, right? The Markov property gives us that parameter C that we cannot determine any further. So that's just called the speed of the Brownian motion. That's a parameter kappa. But maybe I'll just show a couple of pictures.
You need a screen, right?
Yeah. Wow. I'm not offended if anybody gets up and wants to go for lunch or so. I mean, I don't like going over time myself. Anyway, I should just start, in a sense, in a historical order here. That is the loop-erased random walk in a disk. So we start a simple random walk at zero on a lattice. Here it's 750. And whenever we encounter a loop, we erase it, and we stop it the first time we hit the circle. And that model, I think it was sort of invented by Greg Lawler as a simpler model, easier to study than a self-avoiding walk. And that was maybe the decisive one. This is what that first paper was about. So he proved that if this loop erased random walk has a scaling limit that is conformally invariant, then that scaling limit is actually described by SLE, and that the parameter kappa that still needs to be determined comes out of, for instance, dimension consideration. Rick Kenyon had proved the size of the. I mean, then there is one more you need to find. Look at one, have one property that gives you the kappa. Say again. Two. This is SLE 2. Then, but it wasn't proved at that point. It was a conditional statement. If something holds, then it is described by SLE. But that also in that paper sort of explained why the critical, this picture you've seen before, critical percolation on the hexagonal lattice with a boundary condition. So here you have the real line. You said all the hexagons, say white on the one side, left on the black on the other side. For each of the other ones, you flip with a critical probability, which is 1/2 here. You flip a coin whether it's black or white. And then there's that exploration part. You can see that in thick here in the middle, that is just wiggling between the white and the black. So it goes like this. And that path, or that already argued that it would be an SLE 6, but that was the big first result. In that, the first result where conformal invariance and existence of the limit was proved by Stas-Smirnov. So Stas' result was that this one actually has that conformally invariant limit, which then is a SLE 6. And that was actually, I wanted to sort of sketch, not the full proof, but the sort of the ideas that go into that, but I certainly won't do that. And here's a picture. I just copied because I didn't bring many from many of these sources. This one is, I think, from Bernard Nienhuysen's article, explanation of the uniform spanning tree. So here I have that explains, if you do it in a general domain, so first you do that grid approximation, the gray is the domain, you overlay it with a lattice of some small mesh size. You take, for instance, only the portion that is sort of inside the domain, that gives you a graph like here. And in that case, you take some wired boundary conditions. So you have points A and B, or here B and C on the boundary, but now you need to find nearby, I mean, there's a little bit of stuff you do. Then you take the dual lattice and take the original, you take a uniform spanning tree here, and then you take a curve that sort of wiggles. So the dark one, the fat one, is a uniform spanning tree, and then you sort of wiggle around the boundary to get a curve which is, well, sort of called a uniform spanning tree exploration, you could call it. And that one is now known to be convergent to SLE 8. So here's a better picture of
the. Explain to the physicists in the audience what.
Say again?
What uniform means.
Oh, uniform means, so you have all these spanning trees. Now there's a finite number of it, it's a finite graph. And uniform always means each of them get the same probability. So in the first, yeah, that's a good question. I should have mentioned that before. With a loop erase random walk, you get a simple curve starting at zero that goes out to the circle. And the probability for each individual curve from zero to the boundary is actually not uniform. It comes out of the self-avoiding walk. Some are more likely than others. And another model to produce simple curves in the disk from the center to the boundary is to just draw all of these curves. There are finitely many. The number is hard to determine, but sort of it's... There are finitely many, and you take each of them with the same, give them the same weight. That's a uniform distribution. So then that's the self-avoiding walk. So loop erased walk and self-avoiding walk produces simple. And here the same uniform spinning tree, you take all spinning trees with the same one. If you do it on a large...
the critical 4 and 8, that you have this space-filling curve.
Yeah, you're right. So here, you're right, there's a picture I should mention. I mean, there are many things I should mention. So here you see, this is an SLE-8, but this is, in the limit you can see, is already space-filling. And here's a very recent result that was sort of announced, so maybe it's approved by Stas Smirnov, that actually the critical easing interface converges to SLE-3. So here that curve is basically an SLE-3, which still is a simple curve. Then I just want to flash a couple of figures. What I said before, the self-avoiding walks, so you take all simple walks, they're conditioned here in the upper half plane to stay in the upper half plane. They're conjectured to converge to an SLE 8/3. There is that critical number 4. All SLEs between 0 and 4 are simple curves. All SLEs between 4 and 8, they're still curves that surround little that form bubbles. I'll draw a picture in a second. And all SLEs with kappas 8 and more, they're space-filling curves. And so that critical 4, there is a couple of models that are conjectured, like this Rickenius double domino tiling, which is you take, well, you mark two vertices, say, and then you take a domino tiling, random domino, uniform domino tiling here. Another one in the 4-1, you overlay them and you follow the fat and the smaller ones one at a time. You get a path like this that's conjectured to converge to SLE4. There are a few models that are known to converge to SLE4. Scott Sheffield and Odette for the harmonic explorer level sets of the Gaussian free field. So a lot is known, but a lot is also not known. Potts model, O of N interfaces. There's a lot of sort of conjectures.
Wait, is there not pronouncements specific to Ising or any Potts?
Well, I think he says this article, I'm not sure, it's maybe already downloadable. It's an ICM. There are two more articles that I haven't mentioned before that I should like to mention. Both Odette Schrammer and Stas Smirnov, they have an overview sort of article for the ICM proceedings. Schrammer's was written, finished a while ago, but that's for that ICM proceedings. And Smirnov's is also in there. And there he sketches a proof. No. And he proves he has a SLE 3 as a... I think he's optimistic that the method... It's a new, very, very nice method that probably gives some more than that one value, but this I don't know. Okay, so there are zillions of more things I wanted to say, and I wanted to show also how to compute with these SLEs a bit, but I guess I should. Just as an outlook, I should say there are other models that also are interesting, like this Hastings-Levitov, or as I said, that was earlier discussed by others, where you also randomly compose slit ones, but not in a connected one to form a course, but you choose the angle randomly, and then it starts forming these arms. And there is also a parameter involved, which with the slit size is conformally the same at all times. It's a very easy model to analyze, so then we know that dimension is one, for instance, the scaling limit exists. But when that parameter is at the other natural extreme, which is 2, then you are at DLA and nothing is known. Yeah? And so I guess here one can also hope to slowly work your way from 0, eventually ending up at 2, but who knows. All right, I guess I should stop somewhere, so why not here? I spent a lot of time.